Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. July is going to be a big month for the future of ride-hailing companies in Massachusetts. Tomorrow, the state Senate takes up a bill that would add some new regulations for companies like Uber and Lyft. But the Senate's version of the bill differs significantly from the version passed in the Massachusetts House. The Senate version does not require fingerprinting or complete state background checks on drivers, but it does require companies to offer tipping options through their apps. And as I said, all of this has to be decided by the end of the session in the end of July. In a moment, we'll be joined by Chris Taylor. He's head of Uber's office in Boston. But first, a check-in on the status of a major class action lawsuit brought by 350,000 Massachusetts and California drivers against Uber. So we spoke with Shannon Liss Reardon. She is the Boston-based lawyer who represented the drivers, and we asked her if she thinks the Senate's proposal is good for drivers.
Well, I know there's a lot of discussion about the Senate bill and the House bill, and the focus really of both bills has been what these ride-sharing companies will mean and what changes will be required for the benefit of consumers. My focus has really been on the drivers, the labor issues involved, and how the drivers have been affected by the advent of these companies coming into our economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, just another quick question about the Senate proposal. They would require, or it would require the companies to allow tipping through the apps. Now, this is something that Uber does not do. Lyft does do it. And I know this is actually an issue that you have been very active on. And your thought on that?
Yes, I'm quite excited about the provision in the Senate bill that would require the companies, including Uber, to put the tips on the app. I've been fighting for years to get that. And through the recent proposed settlement that I've reached in the case that I have against Uber in Massachusetts and California, I was able to get some changes, including Uber agreeing to stop representing that tips are included in the fare, and also allowing drivers to post signs in their cars saying that tips are not included, and while they're not required, they would be appreciated. But Uber would not agree to put the tip function in the app like Lyft does, which I think would be a huge benefit for the drivers. It's going to mean a lot more money in their pockets day by day, so I'm a big fan about that proposal, that provision in the Senate bill.
Mm. Well, let me get back to your original point about your focus being on sort of the status of employment that that drivers and these companies are disagreeing about, or some drivers. Do you think that there is anything that can or should be done at the state level to further define the relationship between the ride-sharing companies and their drivers?
Well, so I believe that under current law, the drivers are employees. I believe that Uber drivers are employees. I believe that Lyft drivers are employees. I brought cases to try to prove that in court. And the problem right now we have is not so much, I think, with the law we have here in Massachusetts, but with enforcement. Because of what the Supreme Court has done in recent years with arbitration agreements, allowing companies to avoid class action litigation by requiring employees to pursue their claims one by one rather than through class actions. That has been an enormous hurdle to enforcing these laws. So, as you may know, I obtained a major settlement with Uber recently. It's now under consideration by the court in California. It's really a quite, I think, spectacular agreement, given the fact that I was able to overcome the hurdle of the arbitration provision in that case. But that ruling is in jeopardy. So I've gotten what I was able to get so far, given the posture of these arbitration clauses. But this is a battle that will be ongoing.
Hmm. Well, so let me just ask you a couple more questions about the settlement, because as you know, there's been some anger and discomfort about the fact that a settlement was reached at all. And we should say that part of the settlement, Uber would have to pay $100 million to drivers involved in the lawsuit. And folks like Hunter Skolnick, a New York lawyer who's pursuing his own case against ride-sharing services, says that the settlement single-handedly stuck a knife in the back of every Uber driver in the country, and that you, quote, sold out your clients by accepting a payout for California and Massachusetts drivers that's less than 10% of the value of their claims.
Well, for one thing, Hunter doesn't practice in this area. I've practiced in this area for almost 20 years. And he never once acknowledged the fact that we were facing an arbitration clause, which the U.S. Supreme Court has unfortunately allowed companies to use this method to get away with avoiding class action litigation. Now, in my case in California, I was extremely fortunate to get a ruling from the court striking down the arbitration clause, which led me to be able to negotiate this $100 million settlement with these other provisions, such as the termination provision, the tipping provision, and the creation of a driver association. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit last week heard an appeal in a related case, and it is very clear they're going to reverse the court on the arbitration clause. So that decision is going to go away, meaning that if my settlement is not approved by the court, the class is going to go away, and I'm going to be back to arbitrating individually, driver by driver, all these claims. So when someone like Hunter, who again doesn't practice in this area, accuses me of entering into an agreement, he doesn't understand the issues involved. It was because...
Can I just jump in here?
Yes.
Because I want to be sure I understood what you said correctly. Are you saying there's a possibility that Uber drivers could not bring a suit as a class?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That was the risk that we were facing, was because I obtained this really incredible ruling from the judge refusing to enforce Uber's arbitration clause. I think the case is about to be gutted, and we're going to be left to individually arbitrating the claims of only those drivers who come forward and want to go through that process. And we're prepared to do that. We have thousands of drivers signed up to individually pursue arbitrations. But if we have to go that route, if the settlement's not approved, it's only going to be the drivers who call us up and say, yes, I want to go to an arbitration proceeding, who are going to get anything.
And so this would apply only to Uber, because of the appeals court ruling was just looking at the Uber arbitration clause?
Well, I mean, we're facing arbitration clauses in all of these cases. That is the status of the Uber case in particular. I'm also facing the exact same issue with Lyft. I actually have an argument coming up in federal court soon regarding the Lyft arbitration clause. So all of these companies, this is the ride-sharing industry, the sharing economy, and also lots and lots of other companies and other industries, I've been fighting these battles for years, have been protecting themselves from enforcement of the laws against them by putting these arbitration clauses in their agreements with their workers that preclude class actions. And it's because of those clauses, and it's because the U.S. Supreme Court has been so accepting of them, that it makes it really, really hard to enforce the laws that we have on the books. And that's the battle that I've been facing.
So do you think that this is going to, it sounds like you think this is going to affect any sort of future litigation that you want to bring against these companies, that you may not be able to bring the suit as a class?
Well, I mean, this is what I've been fighting for years, is trying to figure out ways to bring these cases as a class in the light of these hurdles. We're working on developing legal strategies to try to get around these clauses. We're hoping that perhaps with a shift we'll be seeing at the Supreme Court, there might be new avenues to push back on some of these rulings, these recent rulings from the Supreme Court that have limited employees from bringing class actions. And then also what we're doing in many cases is we're just taking the companies up on their word and saying, okay, you want these claims to be dealt with individually, we'll do them individually, and we'll file 100, we'll file 1,000 individual arbitrations to enforce these laws. It's not very efficient. Whole point of a class action is you take care of a legal issue all at once for everyone who's affected by it. But these are the games that these companies are putting us through in order to challenge their practices and enforce our laws.
So, do you think that the momentum is with these sharing companies in this new sharing economy then? Because, I mean, if I understand what you're saying correctly, you've kind of hit a major setback here with the whole not being able to bring, perhaps not being able to bring suits as a class. I'm just wondering sort of more broadly if it seems like political and legal momentum is with the companies that are ushering us into sort of the sharing economy, as it's being called.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite so pessimistically. We have...
Some people would say that's the optimistic take, though.
Well, from a labor perspective, I'm very concerned about what these companies have done, trying to create the system that they claim is something brand new. That I've seen this in so many different industries. So many companies are saying that they're providing such wonderful benefits for society that they can just trample over labor and employment laws that we've had in place for decades to protect workers. I am very, very concerned about that. All I'm saying is that because of these legal hurdles that we're facing, particularly because of how the Supreme Court has endorsed the use of arbitration clauses, it has affected how litigators like me can approach these issues. And like I said, we are working on developing strategies to try to continue to enforce these laws. A lot of times those strategies involve bringing the cases one by one, which takes time.
Mm. I should also note that according to Forbes and others, in the Massachusetts and California Uber case, you'd originally asked for 25% of the settlement as your commission, but then later on you cut that proposed fee by $10 million earlier this month. But now I'm hearing you say that if the California court doesn't approve the settlement, any of these terms may not even exist at all.
Yeah, that's right. If the court doesn't approve the settlement, we may be back to square one, and I will be arbitrating these cases for the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt. I didn't settle this case because of the fee. I've been a diehard labor activist, workers' right advocate for nearly 20 years, and that is not the reason that I settled the case. I settled the case because this was in the best interest of the class.
Well, Shannon Liss-Riordan is a Boston-based lawyer who represented Uber drivers in a recent class action lawsuit against Uber that reached a settlement this past April. But again, as she's telling us, it's waiting approval in a California court. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, let's get Uber's perspective on all this. Joining us now is Chris Taylor. He's general manager of Uber's Boston office, a post he took up in January. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So we won't be able to pick through all the legal arguments that Shannon Liss-Riordan presented to us just now, but she did sort of make one overarching point that I'd love your response to. She said in that conversation we just heard that she believes that sharing economy companies, including Uber, are trying to create a system where they promise all these wonderful benefits to society, these are her words, but while doing that, they trample on labor and employment laws that have been existing for decades. And I'm wondering what your response is to that.
So I would say that she's right that labor law has existed for decades in the sense that much of what she's basing her practice on are labor laws that were written in the 30s, 40s, etc. And the world has changed quite a bit since then. I don't think a lot of law has anticipated the invention of the iPhone, let alone companies that are worth billions of dollars that are solely based on an app. I mean, it's definitely a new world, and I think it's changing the way that a lot of people relate to their own cities, how they get around, and frankly, how people, how people earn money. And so I think there's a lot of positive development, and so I do think we're positively contributing to society, and I'd actually love to talk about that if you would indulge me.
I will in just a minute, but I'm still not quite sure I'm hearing your answer about the second half of her critique, which is while creating the sort of lots of tangible and intangible positives for society, she sees companies like Uber basically, in her mind, really exploiting workers or not providing workers the benefits that she believes the law requires.
I mean, I think we as a company would clearly disagree with her interpretation of our position in labor law. That's not my personal area of expertise. I manage the operations side. I've been in Boston for the past about 6 months or so. I was in Chicago for nearly 2 years before that. So it's a little bit out of my field of expertise in terms of the company's position. But, we've been quite public that we think very clearly defined within the law, we're following the rules, and we do think we add a great deal of benefit to the lives of our drivers, and we care about them very deeply.
Okay, so let's talk about some Massachusetts-specific operations then, because at the top of our conversation with Shannon Liss-Riordan, we mentioned that the Senate, Massachusetts Senate, is taking a look at a bill that would introduce some regulations to ride-sharing companies. It's a little different than the House's bill. The Senate doesn't necessarily see the need to add additional background checks for fingerprinting, while the Massachusetts House does. And I presume that Uber likes
that's not the way the House and the Senate bills were. Neither the House bill nor the Senate bill have any fingerprinting options. Both have a Cori check component. The main difference in between the two is whether or not who processes the Cori check.
Okay.
In the House bill, it's the DPU who would be running that process. In the Senate bill, I believe that's left to rulesmaking as to who would process the check. But both have a Corey check component.
Okay. But it seems as if sort of the barrier to entry, if I can put it that way, for drivers would be lower in the Senate bill than it would be in the House bill because of the differences in the checks.
So I would say that the safety outcome is identical. And that's the most important thing. What it does do is it pulls away a lot of unnecessary hoops to jump through in terms of someone who, you know, if you imagine yourself driving, you're a very busy person, you work long hours. If you have, actually, you know, you mentioned it when I came in, like you have kids, and getting to a Department of Public Utilities physical location to get your Corey check run is a lot less convenient than being able to do it digitally. And that's really what we care about, is the safety outcome is going to be the same. We want that Corey check done. We're supportive of that. But we'd love to have it be more convenient for drivers so that they don't have to jump through hoops unnecessarily.
So can you tell me specifically, like, say I wanted to become an Uber driver.
Mm-hmm.
What are the specific checks or the process that Uber goes through to do a background check on me?
Yeah, yeah. So I would say safety is a really important thing for us. And background checks and screens are one component of a whole suite of safety systems we have in place. So I'll touch on the background screening. The way it works is you submit all of your relevant documents. So, you know, you have social security number, driver's license, registration, insurance docs, et cetera. And then us, like many, many major corporations, use third-party private background screening companies that are all accredited. So, you know, similar ones might be Walmart or FedEx, who's going to send a driver to your home to drop off a package. So, you know, they care very deeply about the safety of, you know, their customers, just like we do. And you submit your information, then the background checking company goes through a very long and thorough process validating your identity, and then additionally running checks in terms of, you know, federal databases, every state, down to going physically to courthouses in every place you've lived and worked for the past 7 years.
Every single place?
Mm-hmm. So they'll, based on all of the publicly available databases, which there are many, they will pull records from every courthouse in an area where you've lived or worked for the past 7 years.
And you do that for every person who applies to be a driver in Massachusetts?
That's correct. Nationwide.
Nationwide. Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. I'm curious. I mean, there's so much to talk about, and I actually would love to have you back on the show because
please.
Companies like Uber are they are having a profound effect on how we live. I kind of want to ask you more of a user end question here because it is in the Senate bill that the Senate bill would require adding a tipping option in mm-hmm. the app, which exists now in Lyft. Uber's been adamantly opposed to this. Now, why is that?
Yeah, so you're allowed to tip in an Uber. You can tip. There were some marketing lack of clarity in the past, which Shannon Reardon has brought to bear, and you know,
I mean, you can tip, but it kind of has to be like, it feels like it has to be this very underhanded thing, because all over the, you know, the Uber app and the website and emails even that I've exchanged with Uber as a user, they say we frown on tipping. We don't let the drivers ask. I mean, I feel like I just have to like leave a $5 bill like under the seat.
Hey. Well, so I think we need to be clear that tipping is allowed. And so, like, you know, I want to make sure the record is straight on that one. Tipping is allowed. It's not built into the app right now. So what I would say is that our opposition to systems that are based on tipping are that most research has shown that industries that have workers relying on tipping typically suppress those workers' earnings from a wage component. Like if you look at, you know, waiting tables is the obvious example. People make like $3 an hour and then they survive on tips. And for the most part, when you have industries that accept tipping as a normal form of income, the wages crash down and people survive on those tips. And that's just not necessarily a great system. And it creates a lot of odd pressure for riders that riders don't necessarily like.
Okay. Well, in Massachusetts, I think those jobs that that do have a lower set minimum wage because they are allowed to tip, they're a pretty well-defined group of jobs. I mean, I'm not sure an Uber driver would fall underneath that component. But
I was going to say, which is true. But if you start forcing companies like through app design, like legislating app design as opposed to letting different companies compete to determine what's the right answer, which we think is a better solution.
How about another option, just paying your drivers more?
So I mean, our goal is to make sure that drivers can make a good amount of money from giving trips. Like, that's what we want to do. We want to create a system where riders want to take rides because it's affordable and drivers want to drive because they make the most money on our system. Like, that's success for us.
Well, will you come back?
I would love to.
Okay.
Because you guys are my favorite radio station.
You heard it here. I'm going to ask you, is Radio Boston your favorite program?
No, yeah, absolutely. Obviously. No, my fiance and I will on weekends put BUR streaming on our iPhones and listen while we do stuff around the house. Like, I promise.
I assure everyone journalistically, it doesn't matter what Chris Taylor's answer was about us being a favorite or not. We treat everyone the same with the highest journalistic standards. And I mean that. Chris Taylor, general manager of Uber's Boston office, a job you took up a little earlier this year in January. We'll be looking forward to having you back. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.